Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Words surround us. Words define us. Now a vast new database and tracking tool let us look back over five centuries of words in 5.2 million books to see what's up, what's down, and what's changed in the words we use. This hour On Point, we're tracking words, the words that define us and the world through time. You can join the conversation. How, what should we plug in and track down here today? What words, history, gets your attention? You can comment as well at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now is Erez Lieberman-Aden, Harvard researcher in applied math and genomics, who's been working with Google to dive into the data on words. He's co-author of a big piece in the latest issue of Science called Quantitative Analysis of Culture Using Millions of Digitized Books. Erez Lieberman-Aden, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, it's a real pleasure being here.
It's just great to have you. We're going to look at what you've done and how you've done it, but just give us some examples first of a word or two that you've tracked over time and what you've found.
Sure. Well, there's all kinds of ways of tracking things. I think something that folks have certainly been discussing is the fact that the use of God in books has been in decline by about threefold, really peaked in the early 19th century. That's an interesting case. Probably what you're seeing there is that it's a lot fewer clerical people, a lot fewer clergy people who are writing books these days. Literacy has changed.
We certainly still talk about God plenty, but I'm looking at the chart, and this is at give us the web address where people can go and punch in a word.
Sure, it's ngrams.googlelabs.com.
Ngrams, N as in Nancy, ngrams, ngrams.googlelabs.com. You can plug it in right now. It is really fun, let me tell you. You can spend hours tracking down words here. We've got God plugged in, and you see it peaking, as you say, Erez, back in 1810, 1820, 30, sort of a mountain of references in books of that time as a percentage of all words in all books, at least in the Google database at that time, and then just swooping right on down to bottoming out somewhere, I don't know, around 1970 maybe, a tiny tick up, but nowhere near what it was way back then. You've got another one here on war, the Great War, the World Wars, and what you found there.
Sure. Well, that's an interesting case where what you're seeing is probably not changes so much in interest in a set of events, but changes in how we talk about them. So lots of people from the beginning of what we now call World War I and till the beginning of what we now call World War II talked about the Great War. And of course, that's how they were talking about World War I. As World War II began, what you can see is that the amount of discussion of the Great War absolutely plummets. And instead, you see a dramatic rise in discussion of the terms World War I and World War II. So it's not that people started discussing World War I in the late 30s. It's rather that World War I became the name for the Great War because World War II had begun.
As soon as the big new war starts, the old one can't be the Great War. We're in the new war now. It's amazing how widely you can look sort of out through this perspective on what's going on. Just plug in pizza and pasta. And if you look back here in the database, just back as recently as 1940, 1950, even 1960, very few references of these two. And then an explosion. I mean, just, I don't know how many, it looks like a 10 or 100 time explosion in the frequency of their usage. What we eat changes and the words we use change.
Sure, that's exactly what you're seeing there. I think in that particular case, it's interesting to wonder about what was the driver for the dramatic increase in interest in pizza and in pasta at that time. And you could imagine that it's actually the return of GIs from Europe in World War II who tasted some of the food while they were in Italy, while they briefly occupied Italy, and said, hey, this is great. We need this. And in fact, it's only in, I believe, 1962 that the first deep dish pizza is made in Chicago.
amazing what other things you can just suss out here. It's not only English that you've looked at. You've looked at a number of languages. So if you plug in Jesse Owens, I guess, in English, and around the time that he was winning gold medals in the Berlin Olympics, you see an explosion of references to him in books around that period. But if you look in Germany, where the Nazis were in charge and had denied him those medals, in German, almost no references to Jesse Owens. You see a kind of very active, I don't know, censorship going on there of the whole idea of Jesse Owens. Tell us how you did this, Erez. I mean, Google has what, put 5.2 million books, digitized them, and then what?
Well, no, actually, Google has digitized 15 million books.
Wow.
And,
okay.
And one of the biggest challenges for Jean-Baptiste Michel, my collaborator, and I, was at the early stages saying, hey, you know, some of these books have fantastic date accuracy. You know, you have publication dates that are really, really, really accurate. Some of them have less accurate metadata. Why don't we filter out all the ones that we think we might have any sort of question about those dates? And just save the 5.2 million books where we think the dates are really good, where we think the OCR is really high quality.
OCR meaning?
Just focus on those.
OCR?
Oh, the optical character recognition. So that's when you scan in a text, that produces a picture. But what you want to do is take that book and convert it into digital text. So optical character recognition is a word for all the types of algorithms that are used to convert a picture of text into digital text
automatically.
You've
got computers scanning these millions and millions of book, and then you've got the words digitized through that scan. If it's too fuzzy, or I don't know, the print isn't good, maybe the scan isn't good, maybe the data isn't good. So you're winnowing down to the 5 million plus that you've got a pretty good bead on. And then what do you do with them? I mean, you've got a background in mathematics and genomics. I'm not sure how that applies here.
Well, I mean, I think that this is a very, very large-scale quantitative problem. And the folks who have been sequencing genomes and analyzing genomes going back decades and especially going back to the last 10 years have developed a lot of expertise from that. And so having been sort of schooled in that background, I think I took a lot of inspiration from that. And I think my collaborator did as well. And so what we did is we created essentially a massive table. And this table reflected the frequency of every single word and phrase that occurred in our database with any reasonable frequency at all. And it tracked its frequency over time going back centuries. And then using that table, we're able to sort of rapidly query. And for instance, you can see how the Google tool now serves up entries in that table in a nice graphical form in very, very, very rapidly.
So I can punch any word in here, and I just punched in. I've got a computer and the keyboard with me right here in the studio. I punched in fabulous, which may not be as hot as can be right now, but certainly in the lifetimes of many people has been very hot. And it turns out that fabulous was much more popular as a percentage of all words found in books, I don't know, a couple of centuries ago than it ever was in the recent 20th century. Who knew? Thomas Jefferson and George Washington sitting around saying fabulous all the time at the Revolution. Who knew?
Yeah, I don't think that their fabulous lifestyles had ever been fully appreciated.
Right. Lifestyles of the rich and famous and fabulous. Maybe here. How far back does the database go?
So, you know, asterisks aplenty. JB, my collaborator, and I believe very, very strongly that between 1800 and 2000 in the English language, you can do a very good job with this. But we're not interested in kind of being, you know, paternalistic about it in any sense, right? So we've just made available all the data going back as far as it goes in every language. So in principle, you can track things back to the 16th century, but we urge a great deal of caution in doing that. You have to be really, really careful about that because that data has not been studied nearly as carefully. There are far more errors in terms of this optical character recognition. So sometimes words are misscanned. There's all kinds of peculiarities that way. The data is also smaller. So, for instance, in 1900, we've got about 1.6 billion words in the corpus. In 1800, we've got around 100 million. When you push back beyond 1800 to, say, 1700, the number of texts that we have is just much, much smaller, and so your statistical power is significantly reduced.
Though it's very tempting to go back and look at this. We punched in liberty and freedom, And those get right back in the 18th century in a hurry. Liberty, much, much higher than freedom and peaking out right around the time of the American Revolution. It looks like on your chart almost right around 1776. And then, you know, dwindling down, sort of reaches a low around just after 1900, then bumping up during the Cold War again. Liberty goes right on down. And after, in the 20th century, freedom sort of taking over, and in the Cold War, World War II years, becoming the big one. Freedom supplanting liberty, just interesting.
Yeah, and that's actually, if my memory serves me, that's something that you can occasionally see, not just in English, but in other languages. When there is a big revolution, a huge amount of tumult in a particular society, often terms like freedom and liberty will have peaks because they're being used as rallying cries.
Speaking of rallying cries, and we've seen this reported, but just the word women and how much its usage exploded in the 60s and 70s compared to earlier. And it's kind of astounding to see what a relatively small number of appearances the very word women made in books until Women's Lib, the feminist movement.
That's absolutely right. I think that you certainly are seeing a shift in who's being talked about in books and who's doing the writing and whose concerns are being reflected. And I think there what you're really seeing is especially the concerns, the interest in thinking about women as a whole. So not so much individual female characters in novels, for instance, but really women as a group, an interest in their issues.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise and fall of words, particular words, phrases, over time, and what it tells us about our history, our culture, and the way we see the world. It's possible because of a new online tool now plumbing, 500 years of books that have been digitized by Google. You can link to it at our website. It's Ngrams, and one of the guys who dived in to make it and bring it to us is with us this hour. Erez Lieberman-Aden joins us from Las Vegas. He's a Harvard researcher in applied math and genomics, and he's taken that, along with his colleagues, applied it to a big universe of words. Words in books, 5.2 million books published since 1500. Erez is there in Las Vegas, and with us right now as well from San Francisco, we're very happy to have him, is Jeffrey Nunberg, linguist and professor at the School of Information at UC Berkeley, author of The Years of Talking Dangerously, emeritus chair on the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. You know him well from public radio. Jeffrey Nunberg, thank you so much for being with us today. Are you having fun with this new tool?
Well, I've been having a lot of fun with it. It's a lot of fun to play with. It's not entirely reliable, and it doesn't do quite the sort of thing that you expect from a real database. But it's great fun, particularly if you're looking at recent words and high-frequency words. And there really are these generalizations that you get that are very teasing and very provocative. You say, well, why did that happen? Why did this happen? And so it's a lot of fun.
We're going to look at the mechanism and what you may think of that. But what about what you found punching in words, Jeffrey? You're so great with words and phrases and trends. What did you see? What popped up at you punching stuff into Ngrams here?
Well, sometimes you just have a feeling that people are saying a certain word more often than they used to. So you punch in, for example, the word creepy. And for some reason, we're using the word creepy about 10 times as much as we did 50 years ago. Now, why is that? Is it because of the technology? Well, that accounts for maybe 10 or 15% of it. But if we find, is the world creepier, or do we find it more creepy than we used to?
I mean,
so there are a lot of things. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's amazing. But as a linguist, do you just assume that that's just a new way of expressing the notion of creepiness, or that, as you say, the world's becoming more creepy, so we use it more?
That's one of the problems with this, with these systems, or one of the questions you have to ask when you punch something in. Is this because we're talking about it more? Is it because we're interested in it more? Or is it just because the language is changing? For example, the word propaganda was at a very low level around the time of the First World War. It shot up to a very high level at the time of the Cold War. And then it came down again till now it's almost as low as it was in 1914. Now, does that mean we're less interested in propaganda, or that propaganda isn't a problem? Well, I don't think so. I think we're all concerned about the way in which governments and others can manipulate public opinion through language. But we talk about it differently. And in fact, just about the time propaganda starts to fall off, you see this new word, Orwellian,
yep,
increasing. So that's the sort of thing that has to be explained, and you can't simply take the numbers and assume that they represent a trend in what we're more interested in.
But boy, is it fascinating here. Now, this is you're a linguist. This is words in books. How do you think that compares, Jeffrey, to word usage overall? Do we tend to speak with the same words that we write in books, or would we, if we could somehow, maybe Google will one day, capture all spoken words, do you think we'd see a very different profile?
Yeah, I think so. There are all sorts of words that are either not used at all in books, or that are used much less frequently in books than in spoken language. In addition, you got to understand that these records, these books, were drawn from the collections of libraries. So when you're looking at the books from 1900, you're looking at the books that libraries collected in 1900. When you look at the collections from 1980, it's a very different collection. So if I do a search on murder, for example, I see a gradual rise from the 1920s on. But what does that mean? Well, it turns out that one of the reasons is that libraries just have a lot more murder mysteries than they did in 1920. It doesn't reflect an increase in the murder rate or the fact that necessarily people talk about murder more often. So that's the sort of thing you have to be aware of when you're using this tool.
Eris, how do you look at that? You're drawing this, you're sucking it out of millions of books. So is it a very special thing? I mean, even given it's library books, you know, how reflective, how accurate is it, do you think, in terms of usage?
Well, I think Jeff is absolutely right in many of the comments that he's made. I think that in the paper that we wrote about essentially this type of analysis, we talk at great length about the challenge of interpretation, the question of whether a particular trajectory is coming from a change in what we're interested in or merely a change in how we talk about what we're interested in. We list at some length all of the different digitization projects that are going on right now to try to get access to text, to words, to speech, to even to artwork beyond the world of books. And we talk about a lot of these sources of bias. And I mean, I think the way that I would frame this is that this is data. And like all data that exists in the sciences, it's not transparent. It needs to be interpreted, and it needs skilled interpreters. If you think about the microscope, which was invented in the early 17th century, hundreds of years later, we're still struggling to become better and better at interpreting that lens on the world. And I think that any scientific enterprise of whatever scale ultimately faces that same challenge. And so that's the challenge that we're facing right now with the n-grams, which is we've got this new lens on books, this new lens on culture, but we need to become better interpreters than we currently are.
So not a perfect tool, and watch out on interpretation. And Jeff Nunberg has some misgivings about Google's very sort of a grasp on all this data and these books. Nevertheless, this is a lot of fun. Ahmed on Facebook wrote that he loves the phrase rains, cats, and dogs. So I just plugged it in here. And, Eris, I don't know what you make of this, but you plug in rains, cats, and dogs, and I'm doing this from 1600 up to the year 2000, and there's a gigantic spike around, it looks like 1802, and then it's got pretty good use, but it starts to filter, you know, sort of dribble down in the latter half of the 20th century. I mean, how do you interpret that, Eris? That everybody was writing about it raining cats and dogs in 1802, and or what?
Well, that's a critical point. I would actually suspect that if you type in raining cats and dogs,
yeah,
and you
okay.
compare that to rains cats and dogs, mm-hmm. I think that you can see that raining cats and dogs, which is the more common expression these days, in fact, has actually had a pretty dramatic surge in interest over the past two centuries, since 1800. Rains, cats, and dogs has by and large not done as well. If anything, it's kind of going down. So I think what you're seeing there is, for that particular expression, rains, cats, and dogs versus raining cats and dogs, I guess that the way in which we grammatically phrase that has changed over the last couple of centuries. Now raining cats and dogs is the reigning champion.
Jeffrey Nunberg, what else have you been punching in as you toy with this?
Well, I've looked at I saw one fellow was using it on the internet, was saying, oh, look, the word freedom has become more and more common over time, and doesn't that mean that you have a new birth of freedom and so on and so forth? And what you want to do is punch in freedom and then punch in liberty. And it turns out that liberty used to be much, much more frequent than freedom. It dwindled in importance as freedom was increasing. The two crossed, I think, sometime around 1950, so that now we talk about Operation Iraqi Freedom and Freedom This and Freedom Prize. And in 1914, we talked about Liberty Ships and Liberty Bonds, and we thought we were fighting in the name of liberty. Is that interesting? It's terribly interesting. It's a lot more interesting than the increase in pizza, which is fun but not very important. But it
depends how much you like pizza, Jeff.
That's true.
I guess.
But it calls out for interpretation, as Eris was saying, that's what this tool is good for when it comes up with the right results. Is it providing these very teasing, interesting regularities that you then have to explain.
Boy, is it fun. Let's go to our listeners. Sharon in Arlington, Massachusetts. Sharon, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Hi. Thanks for having my call. This is just right up my alley, and it sounds like great fun. But I do have a comment, and I guess it falls right into the interpretation line, which is that I think it's dangerous to look at these individual words as if they're static and as if the meaning has not changed over time. So you said, you gave an example of the word fabulous.
Yes.
And talked about the 100 years of usage. Well, fabulous used to mean something quite different, and it was much more linked to the uncanny.
The uncanny or the surreal, you know, or the kind of inexplicable.
And now we've got it just, you know, abfab. So I would like to link this tool with what the Oxford English Dictionary has always done, which is to show the history of usage by giving example sentences of usage of the word over time. So I'm wondering if the researchers might think about linking to the OED and doing a kind of cross-check on the history of the meaning of the words, too, as a kind of a next step along the way. And one more example was the women, the use of women. You know, you've got to check that against the use of ladies, because one of the things we did in the 60s and 70s, and now I'm dating myself, is broke away from the confining notions of being a lady to become a woman. So that might be the liberty freedom example as well.
Well, that's very interesting. I just punched in ladies as you were speaking, Sharon, and interestingly to me anyway, or as interpret differently, or Jeffrey, if you will, but there's a huge spike all the way back in the 17th century, maybe when they were speaking of aristocrat ladies, you know, lady this and lady that. Then it drops way off during the period of revolutions, comes back up maybe as it converted to a way of talking about lots of women in the 19th century. And then you're right, perhaps, Sharon, in the 20th century, ladies basically goes away as women takes off. I mean, Jeffrey Nunberg, let me come first to you. Does my lay interpretation sound ridiculous or possible?
I think that's quite possible, and the caller, I think, is also right that the usage of lady versus woman, in other words, girl, for example, has dropped out in favor of women in a lot of contexts. So you have to look at these words in the larger context, what we think the set, the semantic field or the semantic set of words that are doing a certain amount of work. Otherwise, if you track just one word, you're liable to draw the wrong conclusions.
And, Erez, can you link this up to the OED? Is that a bridge too far for your good technical capacity? So we can see, well, what did fabulous mean when, I don't know, Ben Franklin was chortling it over dinner?
Not at all. In fact, interesting, perhaps historical note, is the very first conversation with Peter Norvig about this. One of the central Peter Norvig at Google about this, when, you know, we were still interested in pitching Google that this was a good idea.
Yeah.
One of the applications that we highlighted was, look, wouldn't it be amazing if you had a dictionary that could enable you to do just that? And in fact, we created a mock-up of what such a dictionary would look like and said, well, wouldn't this be irresistibly cool if your dictionary could do this? And I think it's absolutely true. You know, this is the first week of a very interesting new type of data. And I think what we're going to see in the coming weeks, months, and years are more and more of the potentiality that I think Jean-Baptiste and I are really excited about. I think we're going to see more of that potentiality being actualized.
Jeff Nunberg, I know you have some misgivings about this power of the giant database in the hands of Google, the corporation. What are those? As a linguist, as a scholar, it's an awful lot of fun. Where are your misgivings, Jeff?
Well, I have no misgivings about this project as it's been done so far, and I think Erez and Jean-Baptiste have done an extraordinary job of working with very difficult data to put this out there. I do have some concerns in a narrow way about what will happen to this, because it needs an awful lot of work, just this system, before it can be useful in the broad range of ways that, that linguists and scholars would like. If, for example, I want to track the frequency of the phrase colorblind, what I would do with any other collection like this, any other database, mm-hmm. would be to say, well, give me instances of the word colorblind, but only in paragraphs mm-hmm. that contains the words Negroes or race or something like that, so that I wouldn't get the vision sense of the
yeah,
word.
Yeah.
I can't do that with this. More important, I think, is the fact that this database, as Eris said, is strewn with errors. There are misdatings, misattributions, mistitlings. You'll look in there, you'll find a copy of Flaubert's Madame Bovary dated 1799, or with the authorship by Henry James, or listed under Antiques and Collectibles. Now, Eris and Jean-Baptiste made a real effort to purge those sorts of things from this database, but there are still hundreds of thousands of misdated books in this database. So if I look for the word patriotism, for example, a word that was invented in the mid-18th century, mm-hmm. I'm going to find 30 or 40 hits from the 17th century, and every one of them is a misdated book. I'll find instances of cell phone or a word like that from the turn of the 20th century. So there are a lot of problems like this. I don't think Eras and Jean-Baptiste are going to do this. I think Google has to go back and look at this problem, of, as Eras was saying, the metadata, and spend a lot of time and a lot of money making it right. Now, you could say, well, this is a public corporation. They're doing this as a public service. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, and so on. But the fact is that Google has gone to the courts and asked them to approve a settlement agreement that basically gives them an effective monopoly over all of these books, this entire cultural heritage. And the idea that any corporation, even a well-intentioned one, should have that monopoly disturbs a lot of people. Robert Darnton, the Harvard librarian, pulled Harvard out of the project and has been calling for a federal project to do this. How this will sort out depends to a large extent on how Google, what Google does about this. Do they improve these database? Do they improve this tool? So I think the jury's out on whether this is going to ultimately lead to a new form, a new library, or whether this is going to have to be duplicated somewhere else.
So don't bet your life on the hyper-accuracy, but I know I've just got you for another minute, Jeffrey, but I mean, do you really think, can somebody own the language by owning the database of words, or are those two different things?
Well, this is a database of 15 million books that mm-hmm. Google has scanned. They did it quick and dirty, and they did it to get out there, which they admit. They did it to get out there. Nobody is ever going to do that again. No company is ever going to do that again. The only people who could do it again and do it better would be the federal government. Now, whether that should be done depends in some sense on how much you trust Google to make all these errors right, to make this system work, and to deliver to the public something in the public's good. Because the public is giving Google, effectively with this agreement, a license to do this.
So, as a linguist, are you going to be using this tool, Jeffrey, or just as a, I don't know, for a recreation on a Saturday night, a slow one?
Well, you know, if you're a linguist, that's a hard distinction to make. But sure, I mean, and I let me say again, Eris and Jean-Baptiste deserve enormous credit for having done this, and it's just great fun. I mean, just last night, I'm interested in what we think of as the A word. I can't say it on public radio. And I punched in the phrase, such a heel. And then such an A word, that
okay,
word.
Yeah.
And it turns out that such a heel declines
yeah.
at about the same point that such an A word comes in. So the A word has basically replaced heel in the vocabulary. Now, that's the sort of thing you couldn't have done before. And it's wonderful to play with this toy, or this tool, I should say. I hope it will become the kind of tool that will have the robust capabilities that other databases of this sort do.
They rise, they fall, and some words nearly go away. Jeffrey Nunberg at UC Berkeley, joining us from San Francisco today. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the rise and fall of words this hour, particular words, phrases, over time, and what it tells us about our history, our culture, and the way we see the world. It is possible because of the new online tool, Ngrams, now plumbing the 500 years of books digitized by Google. Erez Lieberman Aden has gotten very deeply into this. He's a mathematician and a genomics researcher, and he and a team have helped Google put this thing together. There's a terrific tool you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Plug in any word or phrase you like and look over time at the popularity or the frequency of its use in books. Books in libraries, 15 million plus, Google pulled out and scanned in 5 million, part of this enormous database. It is really pretty cool. Erez Lieberman Aden joins us today from Las Vegas. Erez, I'll take a call here, but while we're getting it, here's a Carol in Downs, Illinois, asks about girls and women. Maybe you can plug those in. Let me get one more while you do. Don's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Don, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to ask about the rise of the word over the last 10 years, random. I've noticed it used as a descriptor from younger people.
That's so random.
That's so random, yeah. I'm wondering how that has a spike.
Oh, okay. I've got that one plugged in right here. And it's interesting, Erez, I don't know if you see it at the moment, but if you look for random, for some reason, way back around 1660, there's a spike. And then it goes way, way down until just after 1900, starts a slow creep, and then explodes in the middle of the 20th century by your count, or, you know, 1950 on. It's just a straight line up almost. What do you make of that, Erez?
So I think that There's a couple of things here, which is this is really one of the dangers of making a lot of data available when the interpretation is just harder for that period before 1800. Most of, in the case of random especially, I think most of what you're seeing there in the late 17th century is actually random noise. It's not real stuff. Now, you can, if you click on that link.
In other words, it's not really there. You wouldn't really see it as a trend. It's random statistical noise in your database.
Well, not just, it's actually that you've got a lot of books that are misdated that are actually piling up in the mid 17th century.
Okay, so we'll ignore that spike.
Yeah, there's a great way to check that, right? Which is that we made available this link that you can have right at the bottom, which says, okay, well, let's search inside Google Books during the relevant period. And you can see that in some periods, the examples are exactly what you want. And in some periods, things are misdated. And so that's what you're seeing there. I mean, again, you know, we've made this data available. People have to be really, really careful before if they're going to look at the data before 1800. I really suggest, you know, for the most part, sticking to that period between 1800 and 2000, unless you're willing to invest a whole bunch of time in looking really carefully at the trajectory and making sure it's the right thing.
Well, then just take us to that mid-century super spike in the use of random. I mean, and again, part of the fun in this is the speculation slash interpretation. I don't know, but you've got a mathematics background. Before young people started using random, before it became so popular recently, as Don is saying, it must have been related to its perhaps to its frequency of the reference in mathematical or I don't know cosmological references in the 20th century as science advanced and got more attuned to randomness.
Well, one thing that I think could be going on is that as our computational resources got better, as computers got more and more powerful, the issue of generating random numbers, which is something that happens very, very often, especially in some of the earlier applications of computers, and certainly something that we do all the time now, although you don't necessarily see it quite as often, you need to generate random numbers or what are called pseudo-random numbers. Yep. And certainly things like that could have driven this particular trend starting in the mid 20th century. I mean, the timing is right. People used to publish books. The Rand Corporation, for instance, aptly named Rand Corporation, published a book which was a huge bestseller called 1 Million Random Digits with 100,000 Normal Variates. That might sound like something that would put you to bed, but that was a great book. That's actually a classic. Yeah. And it's a classic because people needed random digits, and getting them in book form was a good way to do it.
Now, interestingly, down to your question on random, it just soars after about 1950, peaks, and it looks to me like about 1980-something, and then actually goes down a bit. But I'm guessing, Erez, that the that the conversational usage of this may not be fully reflected in published books, just as an example. I want to get back to Carol's question about girls and women. I'm going to put girls in here and see what we get. Man, this is what a great sort of sitting around game. So here's girls. Takes off in the mid-19th century and then just goes crazy in the first half of the 20th century, way up there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very instructive to compare girls, though, to women. If you just put girls and women in the search box, what you can see is that women, especially after 1960, that expression has what we call a point of inflection. There's mm-hmm. just a very, very dramatic change where it starts to skyrocket. You don't really see that for girls. And I think that what you're likely seeing in that case is, you know, the notion is just the word women is a much, much more respectful term by and large. It really is, you know, one of these, to some extent, you know, a product of the feminist movement, you know, that change is a product of the feminist movement. And you don't see it in girls. And I think you're not seeing it there because girls is not a, you know, sort of preferred respectful way of addressing a large group of adult women.
Girls just plummeting in the book appearance after it looks like about 1945 or so here, though you go back in the 30s and 40s. A very, very high presence of girls and women, as you say, just continues to take off. Melissa in Westford, Massachusetts. Melissa, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say I really enjoy the show. I agree with the previous caller, maybe a call back or two, that I really like this idea. I think it's a great idea, but it is misrepresented, I think. For example, the word gay.
Yeah.
It, you know, at times it meant happy, joyful, that kind of thing, but I can't believe now, you know, it has a totally different meaning. So it's going to peak, and how do you know where that peak when the terminology or definition changed? Does that make sense?
Absolutely makes sense. Who wouldn't understand it? And I punched it in while you're speaking there, Melissa. And you see gay as a pretty high in frequency back in the first half of the 19th century, no doubt meaning, you know, fun, good times. And then it goes pretty far down and then just comes back big time in the last 10 or 20 years, and presumably, Erez, I mean, we all have watched this. I mean, this is no longer, this has got a new meaning. This is homosexuality as the meaning, bringing it back in its frequency, presumably.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you have to really be careful with these things. You have to know the query terms that you're looking for. You know, tuberculosis used to be consumption. You've got to know that if you're trying to interpret a tuberculosis trajectory. This actually happens a lot with medical terms where things, you know, come in and then go out. So, for instance, shell shock used to be the term for what we now call PTSD and for what in the middle of the century was often referred to as battle fatigue. If you want to get a good sense of interest in quote-unquote shell shock and that in those concepts, you've got to know that it's gone through mutations in how we talk about it and the words we use.
And people still thinking about fabulous. Ellen in Northampton writes, fabulous surely derives from the word fable. Think of chimeras. It's steeply warped by a California, these days I guess she means by a California bent that makes it mean fab, as in the Fab Four Beatles. And I think you've exactly captured the migration of that particular word, Ellen. And thanks very much for your call. Let's get a call from Nashville. We've got Doug calling from Nashville. Doug, thanks. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
A word that has kind of pricked my ear lately that I'm seeing a lot more usage in TV interviews and all kinds of online interviews is the word absolutely as an answer to a question when a simple yes would suffice.
Right.
Absolutely.
And, right? And we're both tempted to say absolutely in response to that, Doug.
I know,
you're right.
I know, but it makes me think, are people trying to be a little more educated sounding in their answers, or what is the sudden increase in the use of this word? Because the words absolute and absolutely have a definite meaning.
Of course.
And I'm thinking every time that someone says absolutely, they don't really mean it's absolute.
Well, that's such a great question. We've lost our linguist at this point, but Erez has been tracking this. I punched it in while you were talking. If you just punch in absolutely to the database, it's actually quite big around the turn of the last century. It's in the sort of Gilded Age, late 1800s forward, and it actually peaks and starts descending just before 1920. Now, I don't know. I would be skeptical, Erez, that they used it to mean right on or something in 1920.
Well, there's a critical thing that you can do here, Tom, that's very, very illuminating, which is compare absolutely in lowercase, which is what you're looking at and describing right now, to absolutely in uppercase, which is how you would use it if you were just going to have a one-word sentence where you agree, and instead of saying yes, you say absolutely. And what you can see is that absolutely in the uppercase has increased dramatically.
You mean all uppercase are you talking about?
Oh, no, just the uppercase okay. A and then absolutely.
Yeah.
And what you can see is that there's been an increase by about 20-fold in the use of that formulation since 1800. And in particular, there's been basically a doubling since around the mid-1960s. So my guess is that absolutely in the way, in that sort of use instead of yes, probably is often reflected by this capped form.
Doug, fire up your computer and check it out. It's really interesting to look at. Here's one for you to think about. I don't know the answer to this one, but Word Girl in Boston on the website says, plug in the word Google for a real surprise. And I did. Usage peaked in 1900. Now, that I do not know how to explain. While you look at that, let's get to Westfield, New Jersey. Edith is calling. Edith, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm really enjoying this. I really love the idea of looking at words and their background.
Me too.
I have a question, though, for your linguists. Several years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, I read an article about a computer. With the aids of a computer, they had gone back and found, I don't know, 250-some-odd words of the original language. And they traced some of the words through from that time, meaning to today, and queen, for instance, is one of the words that came from one of the original words.
Now, when you say the original words, you mean something before Old English, sort of maybe...
Before Old English, before everything, it was the original language when people first started speaking.
Really words, and maybe queen.
Early words. Anyway, I have never been able to find any reference to that since then, or any link to it or any way of finding out, and I just wondered whether there was any chance that anybody had heard of it and if they knew or knew where I could start looking.
Edith, let us give it a shot. I mean, our pure linguist, Jeffrey Nunberg, is going off. We've got our mathematician and genomics man with us, but he's been deep in words. How far back do you, will you, can you go with this kind of trade? I mean, presumably not before the Gutenberg Bible and the printing press.
Well, so there's all kinds of techniques that people use. So, for instance, if you want to go back as far as you can possibly go, you might compare very, very, very distant languages. And you might say, the word for, you know, a particular the word for something is the same. Let's say for the number one is the same in very, very far-flung languages. That suggests that they all originate from some common ancestor that must predate the dispersal of all of those languages, you know. So it could, does it maybe predate the dispersal, the bifurcation of English and Hindi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And via those mechanisms, you can push back very, 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 very far. But of course, it's a bit of a crude tool. It's a bit difficult to use, and the amount of certainty that we have about claims like that diminishes the further you go back in time. So you can certainly make claims about that. I'm not familiar with the particular claims that the caller is referring to, but the question is, should we believe them? How much certainty can we have about them? That's someplace where it can be very, very, very challenging to not just get the right answer, but to know for sure that you've got the right answer.
Let me get one more, a quick one, before we have to wrap it here. Bart in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bart, you're on the air.
Hello. Here's a phrase that I heard recently, an old phrase that I think Barack Obama has brought it back, ginned up. After I heard him say it, I hear it everywhere. Every commentator, pundit talking about getting ginned up.
Sort of overexcited, or sometimes being made to be overexcited.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyone else has noticed that?
I have heard the president say it a number of times, and others as well. And I just punched it in. Maybe Erez has too. But it looks to me, Erez, like ginned up in your database has a high peak. It looks like around what 1930. again right around 1940, and then a deep valley before coming back since the 80s and really getting big in the 1990s.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that this is actually something that this term probably came up at the right around the turn of the 20th century, right around 1900, and has spread pretty widely since then. You don't see it beforehand, and I suspect that it's a new one, relatively speaking.
It's funny. I think Bart's onto something here, the way politicians sometimes like to reach back into history to words that aren't used so much anymore, but they can lend a kind of authenticity or a legitimacy or authenticity somehow to a point they're making, makes them sound not so trapped in the moment. Of course, words go away practically in here. We punched in fiddlesticks to talk about an old-fashioned expression, and you've got peaks there back in the 1870s, you've got peaks in the around 1920, and then fiddlesticks just practically evaporates, Eris.
Yeah, totally true. You know, that's life as a word, you know.
Right.
That's life as a word.
Right.
And, I mean, I think another great example where a politician had an influence on something but was actually there had been an earlier form is the word nuclear.
You mean with that pronunciation, that sort of
yes,
George
with that
w.
particular pronunciation, I should say.
Right, try that. You'll see where it leads. They come, they go, they rise, they fall, and they tell us something really interesting about ourselves as they do all that. And boy, is it fun to play with this. You can track your own words at Google's Ngram Viewer. We've got a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Erez Lieberman-Aden is the Harvard researcher in applied math and genomics, who, along with a great team, was right in the middle of developing this. And boy, is it fun. He's co-author of the big piece, Quantitative Analysis of Culture, Using Millions of Digitized Books, in the recent issue of the journal Science. Erez Lieberman-Aden in Las Vegas, thank you so much for being with us today. That was really fun. Thanks.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.